Media 1460 WVOX presents The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Now, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX 1416 AM. And my name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I'm the host of this weekly forum. It's coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on Long Island Sound, and it can also be heard live streaming on www.wvox.com. Our guest today is Don Bloom from Greenberg, New York, who's one of the last survivors of the USS Indianapolis, which was the last major capital ship sunk in World War II. Our subject is his story, what really happened, and who was at fault. Hello, Don, and welcome to the Advocates and WVOX studios.
Oh, good morning.
Thank you for coming. Don Bloom was raised in Scarsdale, where he went to the public schools, graduated from Scarsdale High School in June of 1941. He started at Stevens Institute of Technology that summer for introductory courses in shop and drafting and to get acquainted with the other freshmen. After the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor occurred on December 7, 1941, many of his classmates left to join the armed forces. Because he was just 17, he was advised to stay in college because he'd be more valuable as a trained engineer. When he turned 18 in 1942, he enlisted in the Navy and applied for and was accepted for the V-12 program. This program was intense college training for new naval officers to supplement the regular force of commissioned officers already serving with the fleet. In June of 1943, his program started at the Stevens Institute, where he graduated in the fall of 1944 and was sent directly to Midshipman School at Columbia University. He graduated in March 1945, was sent to Washington, D.C. to Gunnery School. In the middle of June of 1945, he was assigned to the USS Indianapolis. After reporting to the Naval Commandant in San Francisco, he was transported to the ship at Mare Island, where it was being repaired in dry dock. He reported aboard, was given orders to leave for ammunition handling school in Seattle, Washington, and after 3 weeks of training, he returned to ship and was told the ship would be leaving the next day for places unknown. He was just 21 years old and had never been to sea before. 13 days later, he was swimming in the shark-infested waters of the Pacific with hundreds of other survivors, and the ship was gone. After being rescued with the remaining survivors, he returned from the Pacific Theater for a 30-day survivor leave. He was assigned then to the USS Franklin, a large carrier located in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, while being repaired after being hit by a kamikaze plane. Eventually, with the end of the war, he was discharged. Later on, he was asked to testify at a courts-martial trial of the captain of the Indianapolis. After the war, he embarked on a long engineering career, and he was recently honored this past December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day, at the Roosevelt Presidential Library. So, basically, each week, meanwhile, as I say, the mission of the Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. Don, when you grew up in Scarsdale, you got to know the Barney Dreyfus family that owned the Pittsburgh Pirates, and you were able to go to a number of major league games when the Pirates in town. You got to meet the legendary Honus Wagner, who, when he retired in 1917, was considered the greatest baseball player in history. Now he's better known as having his face on baseball's most expensive trading card. What was it like when you were a kid meeting the great Wagner, and did you appreciate his reputation? That's before we get into anything else.
Well, the problem is I never saw him play.
Yeah.
But I saw him coach the Pirates when they came to town. He was the third base coach and was generally pretty close to where we had seats.
And he was a big man.
And he was big. He also had bow legs, and I remember that. But I understand he is one of the baseball greats.
Oh, no question about it. It's very interesting that you brought that up when we were discussing it. It's, Wagner in his day, which ended, of course, in 1917, he was the greatest ball player in the history of the National League, for sure. He was like the Ty Cobb of the National League.
Yep.
And he was a big guy for a shortstop. You know, before we get into your sea experiences on the U.S. Indianapolis and your horrendous... was it 4 days or 5 days in shark-infested waters?
We were into our fifth day.
Fifth day. You were a youngster growing up in Scarsdale, New York, and after your graduation from high school in 1941 and during your freshman year at Stevens Institute, Pearl Harbor was attacked by the Imperial Japanese Navy, and we as a country were thrust into World War II. As a young man, only 17, what were your feelings about, and what happened, and what were your impressions regarding FDR's declaration of war resolution? I mean, you probably were quite interested in that.
Well, as far as I was concerned, there was no alternate. He had to. We were attacked. We were wondering at the time when we were going to be involved in Germany, and this sort of precipitated the whole thing. I think Roosevelt was pretty ready to go to war. We had given the British 50 warships, 50 destroyers. We had helped them out completely, and also, as best as we could, the French. Our interests were to see that Germany was defeated, and Japan allied with the Germans, and they attacked Pearl Harbor, and I think there was no alternate.
Mm. Let me ask you a question. Were your friends, and when they heard about Pearl Harbor, was there general shock about the Japanese being able to do that?
Well, we were a bit surprised.
Like everybody else.
And we talked, sat around in the dorm room talking about what our involvement was going to be. We knew pretty much that we might be involved, but we had no idea when. Draft age in those days was 18. We didn't have to register for the draft. At least I didn't. Some of the other classmates did. They were more worried because some of them were being drafted into the Army. And they were reluctant, but saw the necessity.
Yeah. Well, in other words, there was, of course, a great level of patriotic support at that period of time. And how did your parents feel? What was their impression?
They tried to keep me out of the services. Mm. But my brother was already in the Navy at the time. He had gone to MIT and then to Annapolis to be trained as a naval architect of some kind. And he was in the Bureau of Ships in the Navy. And assigned to Washington and also Philadelphia Navy Yard. My sister, right after Pearl Harbor, decided she ought to do something. She's older. And she joined the Army as a physiotherapist. Mm. And so our family was pretty well
represented.
Right, yeah.
You know, when you turned 18 in 1942, when you entered the U.S. Navy, and were qualified for officers training in the V-12 program, which was established to supplement the ranks of Navy's commissioned officers, you were finally assigned to the veteran Portland-class cruiser, the USS Indianapolis. What were your first impressions of that ship, and what were your feelings when, as a 21-year-old, you steamed out of San Francisco under the Golden Gate Bridge and out into the Pacific? First of all, what were your impressions of
the ship? Well, I was just a little disappointed because I had asked for duty on a small ship. And I didn't know when they sent me for training that the 40-millimeter guns, which I was trained to aim and direct, that they really, the big guns, the four-barrel guns, were only on big ships.
Right.
And but I didn't know that at the time, so I thought I was being trained for little ships, which was more to my liking. It had less naval, shall we say, courtesies.
Right. What was your impression when you, I know you mentioned that you were told that to report, and you knew you were on the ship, you knew what was going on. What was your impression when you finally steamed out of San Francisco? Was this like the great unknown? Did you wonder whether you'd ever come back?
That was never, that never occurred to me that I might never come back.
Of course, it was late in the war, too.
It was late in the war, but you don't go to war thinking that you might lose.
Right.
You have to go with a positive attitude, and I think I had a positive attitude.
So this was, in a sense, was it almost like an adventure that you were?
Absolutely.
Right.
At least I had no responsibilities at home. I didn't have to support anybody or anything, and I think that that was a direct advantage to me. I didn't have to worry about what was going on.
So did you write your last letters, and your last letters were sent, I gather, at that period of time? I know no, you couldn't give a location. You didn't even know where you were going anywhere. No one knows.
No.
Where they were.
I just continued writing letters. It was no different. I couldn't report where I was going or what I was going to do or any plans. But other than that, I would write my letters about some of the people I was meeting.
Yeah. Do you still have the letters today from your parents?
No.
Oh, that's interesting.
All gone.
Oh, wow. What? Why? Your parents never
saved
them?
Well, my parents passed away, and the few letters that they had saved, I think, got thrown out, too.
Too bad. You know, your first assignment was to command a 40-millimeter anti-aircraft gun battery on the starboard side of the Indianapolis. This must have been quite a daunting experience and a lot of responsibility. How often was your battery fired in practice? And on the ship's run to Pearl Harbor, were any enemy planes spotted, or had the war moved much further west to see any action?
Well, as we left San Francisco Harbor, target plane came along towing a target, and we fired at that. Approaching Pearl Harbor, where we were going, another target plane came out, and we aimed and shot down that target. After that, we had no use of the guns. We didn't fire them very often.
Yeah, well, it's true, and most of the war was north and west of the Philippines by that time.
Correct, and we were going to go to the Philippines for shakedown, which is a practice runs. We never did have a shakedown. Most of the crew was brand new, like myself, at least 30% or so was brand new. And we didn't know how to fight the ship.
That's interesting. You know, the Indianapolis, which weighed 9,000 tons, was commissioned in 1932. It was the host of to President Roosevelt a number of times. It had been refitted at Mare Island Shipyard before you came aboard on your maiden voyage. And the ship made great time to Pearl Harbor, you talked about. What did you learn about that run, and how unique was that effort?
I only learned that it set a world record when I read it in the one of these magazines that said we had set the record. I didn't know we were going fast. I thought every ship went 30, 32 knots. And
that's a pretty good speed.
Yes, it was. And we were told to stay off the bow because it might be waves coming over the bow.
And knock you
off.
There
were.
Yeah, right. I can imagine.
And there were. And
how do you recall how high the waves were? Was it calm? You know, they say Pacific is a peaceful ocean. How was the cruise? Was it
at that time?
Yeah.
Well, it was rough because the ship was making
moving.
A lot of noise.
Right.
And but I thought that this was normal. It was my first trip.
Were there escorts with your ship?
We had no escort. Traveling alone. And I stood watch and had a chance to talk to my gun director, who was a Filipino and didn't understand much English, and nor I his Filipino.
Right. Tagalopan or whatever.
But he was a decent sort, but we couldn't have much talk.
And that's probably, and being on the ship for such a short period of time and having what you had, the 12 to 4 a.m. watch, I mean, when was the time to meet anybody?
Well, that's the whole point.
Yeah. You know, upon arriving at Pearl Harbor, which was located, of course, on Oahu, Ford Island, you know, the major area, it's the major island in the Hawaiian chain where most of the ships were docked. Were you and your shipmates allowed to have shore leave?
We weren't allowed on the dock. We were told to stay aboard. I was given a watch to make sure the ship didn't shift. And that was it. I couldn't put a foot on the gangway.
So you saw nothing of Pearl Harbor.
I saw nothing.
Now let me ask you a question. What was your view of the damage at Pearl Harbor? Were you able to observe that?
I didn't see any at all. On the way in, I was below deck, and I just didn't get a view of Pearl Harbor at all.
Oh, that's
just the fuel dock.
Yeah, that's very interesting. You know, later history tells us that the Indianapolis was carrying important parts of the atomic bomb to the island of Tinian, where it was, of course, assembled. And as people who have read any history about this knows that the Enola Gay and the Boxcar and the other B-29s took off from Tinian Island. There was some onboard secrecy, and there was a large object on board, and it was guarded at all time. Did that raise any curiosity with you or the crew?
I wasn't so curious, I later learned that was just a bunch of gunned parts. That was a big box on the hangar deck, and I had no idea, because don't we always do this?
Right.
I did note a certain box in one of the officers' stateroom that there were a couple of messengers, apparently.
Right.
And I only learned that they were messengers later. But they were supervising their own bedroom and were watching over it very carefully.
Right. And can we assume in retrospect that only Captain McVeigh and maybe his executive officer had any knowledge of the cargo? Do you think they
These
even
messengers told me later the captain didn't know.
Oh.
Nobody knew on board the ship except these two messengers,
oh,
whom I learned later were physicists from Columbia University.
Wow. So when you docked at Tinian and the ship headed for your next, for the Philippines, and what were your thoughts as you neared the Northwest Pacific? In other words, you had dropped off whatever happened in Tinian. You probably didn't even know what you were dropping off.
We had no idea.
Any clue. It wasn't done in a sense of everybody made an announcement. So once you left Tinian and you were heading for Leyte Gulf in the Philippines.
Excuse me. No, we went to Guam.
Guam. Oh, I see.
And that was overnight.
And then you then headed to the Leyte.
Yeah, at Guam we took on more ammunition to fill the magazines. I didn't know how much was down there because I never was in the magazines.
Right.
But the next day we left.
Now let me ask you a question. The sense of heading for, you know, the Philippines. Now, of course, there was still fighting, not much in the Philippines going on, but how did you see your role? Did anybody on shipboard explain to at least the officers what the mission of the Indianapolis was, or not at all?
We suspected that we were going to attack Japan itself, and that the scuttlebutt in the wardroom was that we probably would be trained for a few weeks so that the new crew, which was about 20 or 30% of the crew, was new, including me, to fight the ship and work together to be able to operate everything properly.
As a team, basically.
As a team. And we would go through that training in preparation for an attack on the main islands of Japan.
Now, at that period of time, the last action was Okinawa, as I believe.
Well, that had been secured.
Had been secured by that time. So, in other words, even the kamikaze attacks that had happened in and around first Iwo Jima and then Okinawa were really over in that sense. Is that correct?
No.
No, they were still...
The kamikaze attacks were pretty successful in eliminating a lot of Navy ships.
Sure. But was that still by July of the 25th or so, or 26th of July 1945, was that still hot and heavy around the Okinawa area?
I don't know. Don't know.
Don't know. But that was there a lot of talk amongst your, I mean, of course, and you were basically at that time 12 or 13 days on the Indianapolis. What happened? How many officers met at mess or because everybody was on different shifts? Did you meet the same
guys?
On our ship,
there were 85 officers.
Yeah.
I was one of the lowly ensigns, brand new. I was at the bottom of the ladder. There were half a dozen other ensigns who were beneath in rank or rating rank. We had a lot of scuttlebutt about what was happening.
Mm.
All rumor. Really, none of us knew much. The senior officers aboard were not our friends. Our friends were, talked to the other guys who had just gotten out of college and trained like myself.
How much mixture did you have with enlisted men, other than the fellow in the Filipino fellow who was in your...
other than him, almost months. Zero.
Oh, that's interesting.
We were told not to fraternize with the enlisted men. If that's Navy tradition, the same thing goes on in the Army. The officers are leaders, and they don't fraternize with the
They don't get friendly. They don't ask too many questions. And you learn very little about what goes on. What was your impression? I gather with the, of course, VE Day had happened on May 8th, a few months earlier. The war ended in Europe. Japan was practically, almost completely had retreated to the home islands. I mean, there were Japanese troops in Manchuria, and there were isolated pockets, you know, throughout New Guinea and areas that had been circumvented, as they said, island hopping, you know, and these were isolated areas, and some of these Japanese soldiers remained for decades. I think a couple of them surrendered 20, 25 years after the war, you know, in fact. So what was your impression? Was everybody really concerned about the invasion of Japan? Was that really the pervasive thought?
Well, we didn't talk much about it.
Hmm.
We just knew that it would be difficult, that probably we would be used to bombard the shoreline. And, we weren't going to be landing on the island.
But you would be exposed to kamikaze attack.
We would be exposed to attack, and there could be a lot of casualties.
Mm.
And we'd rather not have. We knew a little bit about what happened at Normandy, and that wasn't very good.
Mm.
And there, the natives, the people on the shore, welcomed a lot of the army.
Mm.
In Japan, that wouldn't be the case.
Right. Yeah. So, in other words, this was really, after all these years of war, of course, not affecting you. You were basically in training for 3 years,
yes.
I would say this. Some of the others probably were really wondering if at the end game they were going to be exposed to a violent finish, you know, in a sense. And I gather, of course, and later on we'll talk about the atomic bomb, and which, you know, ended the war very, very quickly, and I think everybody was, you know, quite happy about that. Had you, you know, you had a background in engineering. Had there been any talk in your time about atomic energy or fission?
Very little. I had some exposure to the disassociation of ions and some particle physics. having been to school where we knew that there was energy packed in an atom, but nobody took it seriously because nobody knew anything about it. At least I didn't know of anybody who knew anything about it.
It was more science fiction of...
A little bit. Yeah. One of the professors at Stevens was Irving Langmuir. And Irving Langmuir took over the... He was not there at Stevens. He was with General Electric or Westinghouse, I forget which. But he had worked with Adams, and some of his teaching had been left over at the school.
So there was, in those days, it was more of a Flash Gordon kind of thing. People, there was talk about it, but no one had any idea that this would get to, you know, this kind of level.
No.
You know, yeah, it's interesting because I'm pretty sure at the time when people heard about the, and we're going to talk a little bit more of that as we get along. You know, we're coming up against a commercial break, and I want to remind our audience, you're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM and live streaming on www.wvox.com with Richard Garfunkel, and my special guest is Mr. Don Blum, a lifelong Westchesterite who was raised in Scarsdale and was a survivor of the U.S. Indianapolis, our last capital ship, may have been one of the last ships sunk in World War II, I gather. And when we come back, I'm going to ask Don Blum about the night of July 30th, 1945, and what were his earliest impressions of what transpired.
This is the authentic voice of the people.
It's a community station.
AM 1460 WVOX.
Hull Construction and Restoration in White Plains asks our WVOX listeners to please give blood generously. By doing so, your efforts could save the life of a child, a surgery patient, even an accident victim. So please, give blood today. And this special reminder, courtesy of Richard at Hull Construction and Restoration in White Plains. They're the professionals serving the area with top quality work, integrity, and dependability. For service or an estimate, call 914-220-0111. That's 914-220-0111.
A lot of people sell office equipment, copy and fax machines. Some of the technology they're peddling is superb, and some of it is not so stellar, I'm afraid. Thus, the dealer you buy from is just as important, you know, as the brand you select. Since 1972, the most respected, reliable dealer has been Vista Business Products. George and Bob Forstbauer's Vista, number one authorized Canon dealer in the tri-state area. They're the oldest and most established. So for the very best, up-to-the-minute technology in copying, document management, rely on Vista, the newest technology from the oldest dealer. Westchester headquarters in Elmsford off 287 and 119. Call George or Bob Forsbauer. Their sons, George Jr., Bob Jr. There's even a daughter, Christine, in the family business. Vista Business Products and Canon.
Call 914-347-7888 or visit us on the web at www.vistacanon.com.
Here is an important message for all our loyal advertisers who have helped to make your own WVOX the great success it has become over the years. We are having an on-air 50th anniversary celebration to commemorate our 50 years of broadcasting. Yes, 50 years. And you're invited to participate all day long on our very special day, Monday, September 14th, 2009. Our executive staff, our news department, our music department, our sales department are all working diligently, as the Sondheim lyric goes, putting it together. But we need the help of our advertisers to put together messages of remembrances of WVOX, the local station with the national reputation which influenced you and contributed to your success. We want to put your special anniversary message on the air throughout the day when we celebrate our 50th. So please call me, Judy Fremont, at 636-1460 so that we can discuss your special message about WVOX, headed all these years by our charismatic Bill O'Shaughnessy.
Forecast Westchester County in the vicinity for this Wednesday afternoon. We'll see hazy sunshine giving way to increasing clouds, shower, thunderstorm coming likely this afternoon, some strong and severe, highs into the upper 70s. Shower, thunderstorm likely tonight with some gusty winds and heavy downpours, lows falling into the middle 60s, mostly cloudy, showers likely continuing on Thursday, slight chance of an isolated thunderstorm, highs upper 70s, then becoming partly sunny. Friday afternoon, highs into the upper 70s, mostly sunny Independence Day on Saturday. Looks sunny and dry for Sunday as well, highs up near 80. I'm Steve Pelletieri, Jr., reporting for WVOX, WVIP, Whitney Media. WVOX.
Now, back to the Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to the Advocates. I'm chatting with my guest, Mr. Don Blum, who was a Navy ensign and a survivor on the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. I have a book here, by the way. It's called All the Drowned Sailors, The Cover-Up of America's Greatest Wartime Disaster at Sea, The Sinking of the Indianapolis, The Loss of 880 Lives, because what the author says is the incompetence of admirals, officers, and gentlemen. And it's an interesting book. I read it many years ago. My guest, Don Blum, is one of 60 survivors of the original crew that sailed out that evening of 1196. Is that right, Don?
That's correct.
And this book was written, quite a while ago, 26 years ago already. The story hasn't changed much. It's still the bottom line. We're going to explore it in the next half hour. You know, on the night of July 30th, 1945, what were your earliest impressions of what had happened to the ship, Don?
Well, it sank.
But I mean, how did you you heard something. What alerted you to the problem?
What alerted me was I was up on watch, just high up after the second stack, and all of a sudden I saw flame shoot out of the forward stack, and the ship shook, all the noise-making motors and engines stopped. And I figured, maybe a boiler blew. And I had to, pick myself off the deck because the whole ship shook. Then I guess less than a minute later, there was another explosion and more flames came out of the stack. This time it was both stacks. And I, again, had to pick myself off the deck. Then we had sound power phones connecting us to the forward gun mount. And I called across the gun mount to yell up to the bridge to find out what was happening. And I got back the word to load all guns and shoot at anything that moved. Of course, it was just after midnight and everything was black as pitch. We didn't see anything. Yeah. Then we started circling to the left, and the top of the ship leaned outward to the right. And I figured, well, that's because we had been going fairly quickly and we did tilt when we turned.
Right.
I felt everything was going to be okay. I sent somebody for life jackets that we should have had. My director Pointer had one, but I did not. I sent one of the messengers for life jackets. I never saw them again.
Mm. What did you, when you saw this fire coming out and the ship starting to list, then you started to realize the ship was listing, it wasn't just turning. Yeah. What was your next actions? What did you do when you saw this list was starting to...
Well, we tried to stay in touch with the forward gun mount where we had a sound power phone. There was... All our electric was out. All our other telephones were out. And we kept turning to the left and listing more and more and more. And... I slipped and fell when we were about 30 or 35, 40 degree list. And I figured, we may be in real trouble.
Right.
And I saw aft, just enough aft, to see that one of our motor whale boats, which were on davits off the stern, start to go under. Mm. And...
And just so our audience knows, when you get to 90 degree list, you're on your side.
You're on your side.
Just about the capsize. So 45
Correct.
Is about halfway there. And what I gather you made up your mind a critical decision to get off that ship.
Well, I figured that we were going to turn over, but I didn't have long time to think about it.
Right.
I finally climbed up the protective combing that's around the director pointer, and I looked down on the water and could see there's a lot of boxes and things, a lot of debris in the water, and my director pointer was on the edge of the shield, and he said, "Now, Mr. Blum, now, Mr. Blum." I said, no, wait, and jump. Don't...
Dive.
Don't dive. And he waited and waited, and we waited until we were right next to the water, maybe 2 or 3 foot
Wow.
Above it. And I said, okay, now jump. Don't dive.
Right. And you jumped
and
in
did.
After.
Yeah. We did. He went off. I went off after him. And... I swam as fast as I could away from the ship, and when I had to get a breath of air, I turned around to take a look, and I saw against the sky a propeller coming down on me, and it was still turning, and I was motivated to swim even faster.
I can understand. What happened to your this fellow that was in the gun mount with you? Did he survive?
He survived. I never saw him again until I met him in the hospital in the Philippines after we were picked up.
Right. So what were your next instincts once you're in the water and you were covered with oil, I gather?
Well, I didn't know I was covered with oil. at the first start, I said I had been eating a sandwich when the ship was hit. And I looked around and I said, this has got to be a nightmare I'm having. It's not for real. The water was warm. It was comfortable enough. But I figured that this can't happen. It doesn't happen this way.
Right.
But apparently it did.
And the ship, so our audience knows, we're here with Don Blum of the USS Indianapolis on WVOX. The Indianapolis rolled over and sunk in 12 minutes.
That's it.
Right.
And the bow went down first. And leaving the propellers the last thing to go down. Mm-hmm. And that's what I looked up to see.
Now, you were able to swim to a group of about 150 other sailors that had linked up some lifeboats. Tell us what was racing through your mind and what was happening with the other men at this is happening. Just your adrenaline must have been kicked in quite
well. Well, I don't know. Yeah. I was in the self-preservation mode.
Right.
And, but I was alone for 15, 20 minutes, half an hour. I'm not sure how long. Mm. And a couple of men called to me. They saw me they had one rubber blow-up
dinghy
preserver.
Right, yeah.
And they had one, and I went over with those two others. We spent the rest of the night from midnight until sometime during the next morning holding on to that. My arms were getting very tired. We couldn't put it on because it's only for one person. Three of us hung on to that with our hands until we saw a large group. However, I did find a loose life preserver in the next morning, a Mae West type, which I want to put on.
Well, when the reality of your position started to sink in, I gather, through the evening and probably the morning, how'd you deal with it? What kept you from losing hope?
Well, the first thing I did was throw up the sandwich. Mm. And I don't know, to this day, I don't know whether it was because I may have swallowed oil or just excitement.
Yeah.
What was going through my mind was self-preservation. Right. Somebody will be by for us very soon.
Right. We got to go to another quick break. I want to remind our audience, you're listening to WVOX 1460 AM. We're live streaming on WVOX.com. My guest is Don Blum, who was an ensign on the ill-fated USS Indianapolis, which was sunk on its way to the Philippines on July 30th, 1945, almost 64 years ago. Out of the crew of 1,196, only 320 survived the sinking from exposure, dehydration, attacks of sharks. When we come back, our guest will discuss his rescue and his connection to the USS Bassett.
This is America's great community radio station.
Really seems to be in touch with the heartbeat of the city.
AM 1460 WVOX.
Westchester Meadows in Valhalla reminds us that each summer, thousands of senior citizens are at high risk for heat exhaustion, even death. So if you know of a senior alone, please make it a part of your summer routine to check regularly on their health and welfare. Your time will assure their safety. This message from Westchester Meadows, a continuing care retirement community in Valhalla. For information, call 914-989-7822. Remember, love is ageless and growing older should always be graceful.
There are quite a number of neighborhood flower shops around Westchester County these days. As in all things, some are better than others. And in the Colonial Village Shopping Center on Weaver Street in Scarsdale, just to the north of New Rochelle, there exists a florist of very great style and renown. Colonial Village Flowers specializes in beautiful seasonal flowers arranged in good taste, with the lovely low-key result that all Colonial Village presentations, bouquets, and arrangements look like they were actually grown, collected, and gathered in the natural setting of your own garden. Good taste in flowers has for years been a special trademark of Joe Ward and his talented floral arrangers at Colonial Village, featuring the natural look, without pomp or ceremony. So please, know that there is at least one flower shop on your classy wavelength. Joe Ward's Colonial Village Flowers at 1515 Weaver Street in Scarsdale. Call 723-2888. That's 723-2-3-8.
Okay, class. Today's lesson is on cleanliness. Raise your hands if you think Dippin' Car Wash of Mamaroneck is a great place for your valuable automobile. Ah, good. Everyone is in agreement. Now tell me, what should my precious car expect when it enters the loving hands of owner Rocco Dalvito and the staff of Dippin' Car Wash? Very good. You already know that Dippin' Car Wash is famous for their wide range of car washing techniques, including my favorite, Super Polish Wash, Anti-Wax Protection Hot Wax, and their Power Shower, which effectively removes excess dirt from your automobile. Class, did you also know the famous Dippin' Car Wash offers Armor All for your tires and interior? Dippin' Car Wash is open 7 days a week in Mamaroneck at 712 Mamaroneck Avenue, or call 914-698-9515. Westchester's famous Dippin' Car Wash has the most courteous attendants who will be glad to explain the many services now available at Westchester's premier car wash.
Back to
to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Yes, welcome back to The Advocates. And our guest today is Don Blum, one of the survivors, 320 survivors of the USS Indianapolis, the last capital ship, maybe the last American ship sunk in the Second World War. There were only 60 survivors left of the original crew of 1,196. The story's been told many times about the 4 or 5 days in the water, sailors ravaged by dehydration, exposure, shark attacks. It's a terrible story. Don, tell us about your rescue and your coincidental connection with the USS Bassett and what happened to that ship and how it's sort of a unique story about that. How did that come about?
Well, Edgar Bassett was a Scarsdale boy, had gone to the high school, but he was killed during the beginning of the war as a hero, as a Navy pilot. And they named a destroyer transport after him. And I think I was the only one that ever connected with that ship.
So when that ship came up, you saw the name, you must have been in shock.
I did not know. I knew that this was the Bassett he was named after. Oh. I didn't know that until I got home.
Oh. But you knew Bassett's brother and sister. Is that correct?
I had met Bassett. My brother and sister knew Bassett much better. He was in there, closer to their grades.
Yeah. And what had you had now been in the water for how long at that period of time?
When I was picked up?
Yeah.
I was in the fifth day, over 100 hours.
And were you shocked that no one had come to the ship's crew rescue?
Absolutely. We were not sure whether we had gotten an SOS off. Ultimately, it was discovered that three ships had picked up our SOS and had ignored it.
Now, what happened, and you mentioned to me something about the Bassett. Bassett was never mentioned as one of the rescuers.
The Bassett was not mentioned as one of the rescues on the monument in Indianapolis. And I asked somebody who was on the Bassett why it wasn't mentioned. And he said that, well, there was a mutiny on the Bassett. What happened is that they picked me up in a little LCVP, a little landing craft. There were four of them. The Bassett had put out four after midnight. It's still dark. The one that I was picked up by, we couldn't find the Bassett. The lights were all off.
Right.
Everything was off. They did not answer the hand radio. They ignored us. And I was very anxious to get aboard the Bassett because there was water there.
Right.
And I was quite thirsty.
I can imagine.
And anyway, I asked about that. And what happened is that the captain of the Bassett had gotten a report of a submarine in the area, and he said, I'm not going to risk my ship, full speed ahead.
Wow.
And we're getting out of here. At that point, the executive officer and a few of his people locked the captain up. And
sort of like the Kane Mutiny.
Right. Yeah. And actually, when I got aboard the Bassett, I didn't meet the captain until the next day.
You know, after the war, there was an intensive inquiry to what happened to the ship, who was responsible, why was the knowledge of a sinking a mystery to Naval Headquarters. Could you tell us a bit about the inquiry, the courts-martial of Captain McVeigh, a highly decorated and thought-of officer, and the prevailing opinion aside from the top brass? Why was so much fault laid on McVeigh?
They had to blame somebody. I was at a court of inquiry in Guam, and they were asking me questions about whether I saw any homosexual acts on the rafts or in the water. And I thought to myself, why didn't they send a rescue ship? Why didn't we were due in the Philippines on a certain hour. Navy ships run on like train schedules. Why didn't they start looking for us?
Right.
None of that was brought out.
And was that ever determined later?
We don't know.
Right. So you mentioned to me there have been a number of books written. Of course, I have this book here, All the Drowned Sailors, a number of books, a number of television treatments. What was who initiated the pressure on McVeigh? And just to tell your audience, you know, 700 ships were sunk in the Second World War, U.S. ships. This is the only captain who was court-martialed, McVeigh, and they brought in the Japanese submarine commander of I-58 to testify against them. What was the reason for the conviction?
Well, my story is a little different than everybody else's. But the parents of somebody who was lost, who lived in Scarsdale, whom I knew, and I knew I would have to go visit, went down to see the captain. And the captain put him off and said, "Oh, I'm too busy. Come back next week." Well, these people had lost a son, their only son, and they called a good friend of theirs who was named Forrestal, who just happened to be Secretary of the Navy. And Forrestal said, "Would you hold on, please? There's somebody I want to get on this wire." And Forrestal said, "Harry, are you there?" It was Harry Truman.
Wow.
And Truman heard the story of my friend's parents, and Truman just said, "Get him."
Right.
And get him they did.
So in other words, his indiscreet actions of putting them off annoyed enough of the top people to go after him. Now, of course, the question he was convicted on was the fact that the ship did not zigzag. And in naval parlance during the war, ship zigzagging would make it less of a target for a submarine. Now, the commander of the submarine said it didn't matter. You know,
that's correct.
Right. And he was convicted on that basis. And later the conviction was thrown out by Admiral Nibbets.
Right.
What did the Navy say to the charges that there were no escorts and that they had lost contact with the ship? Well, what was their answers to that?
They never gave an answer. There have been no answers on that. That's all. There was negligence on their part. They were just as happy to convict the captain of anything and take the limelight off the people who made all the mistakes.
And, you know, the captain, interestingly enough, was pretty highly rated fellow and highly decorated, and he was a rising... He had a rising potentiality in his career, McVeigh. He was commanding a heavy cruiser. It was a well-known cruiser, the Indianapolis, very famous ship. The president had sailed on it, etc. So what happened when his... conviction was vacated?
His conviction wasn't vacated. His sentence was.
Oh, I see.
The conviction stood until this 12-year-old youngster in Florida, 50 years later, did a history project about the Indianapolis, and he won second prize for his effort. It was brought to the attention of the senator in Florida, who brought it up to Congress, who passed a ruling recommend the Navy that the captain be exonerated from the
court martial. And he was already dead, of course. Had now. It's interesting that what did Nimitz say? So Nimitz basically vacated the sentence, did not ameliorate the guilt, but. McVeigh stayed in the service till 1949, I believe.
I believe that's right.
And then he resigned. I assume there was a lot of pressure, and he later killed himself a number of years later. What precipitated that? Guilt? How did you observe that?
I don't know.
No.
I personally did not like the captain as a person. This had nothing to do with his, with the sinking of the ship. He was doing his job. He was not negligent. Why did he kill himself? Why does anybody? I don't know.
Let me ask you a quick question. We're running down in time. Had he ever go to any of the reunions? I know you told me that you were to two, and they're biannual. They're every other year.
Yes. I have been to three, actually, because I wanted to meet this 12-year-old kid who got the bill through Congress. I wanted to meet him. But I was disappointed in one way. He was no longer 12 years old. He was 18 when I met him.
Right. And McVeigh, did he ever go to any of the reunions?
He went to one. I was never there when he did.
You know, this was a fascinating hour. It goes too quickly. There's so much to discuss about this. We didn't, of course, get into Don's experience. I don't think he wanted to mention too much about his experiences in the water. It was quite harrowing, as we all know. We've run out of time. I want to thank Don Blum, one of our Navy veterans from the Second World War, for joining us this afternoon on WVOX and The Advocates. Next week, I'll be hosting Dr. Lily Link, and she'll talk about her theories on diet and healing. If you want to hear any of The Advocates broadcasts, you can access them at advocates-wvox.com. It's online. All the shows are archived there. Thank you very much, and have a great week and day. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Advocates on 1460 WVOX. The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Tune in again next Wednesday at noon for The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX.